Welcome, everybody. My name is Eugenio Menegon. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Asia here at Boston University. And before I introduce today's speakers, I'd like to spend a moment to thank Amanda Miller, Gail Davis, and Megan Driscoll from Global Programs who have made this event possible. Thank you so much for your work. And of course, our sponsors as well. Also to remind you that in line with this discussion about the issue of democratization and democracy in China, we also have an event coming up at the beginning of December organized by the Center for the Study of Asia. You will find some flyers outside. Joe Fewsmith, sitting at the table here, is the coordinator. The title is Taiwan's Elections, Cross-Strait Relations and Taiwan's Role in East Asia. And of course, this also involves the big presence of China. So you are invited to join for that event as well, and you can find information outside. Also, outside, it will be possible for a few of you to purchase a copy of Rowena Hsu's book, Tiananmen Exiles, Voices of the Struggle for Democracy in China, for $23. But obviously, you can also purchase it on your own. There are a few copies available.
And I'll be happy to sign.
So let me spend just one word for each of our speakers. Joe Fewsmith is well known to the BU community. He's professor of international relations and political science at BU and part of the Partee School. You find his biography there. Why did we invite him? Because he wrote a book entitled, he wrote a book entitled The China Since Tiananmen, that's already in his second edition, that came out in 2008. And also, a few years after Tiananmen, he wrote another book, The Dilemmas of Reform in China, Political Conflict and Economic Debate. He's also someone who regularly monitors the changes in the Chinese leadership. So he's really someone that in the United States probably has a very rarefied and special knowledge of that world. We have then Rowena Xiaoqinghe. She is the author of Tiananmen Exiles, Voices of the Struggle for Democracy in China, published in April 2014. And this book is the result of 8 years of collaboration with political prisoners and student leaders of the 1989 Tiananmen movement. Not only that, she also teaches a course, and you can visit her website online at Harvard, on the Tiananmen movement and its aftermath. And she has earned also the Harvard University Certificate of Teaching Excellence for that course. So I think that we are very happy to have her today for those reasons. Finally, we have Rob Weller, former chair of our anthropology department and member of our institute, Cura Institute, and he's interested in the limits to authority in all its settings. He's an anti-authoritarian in some way, and he has written a book in 1994 comparing three cases of resistance in China and Taiwan. And the analysis there hinged on the unusual moments when it becomes possible to impose a unified interpretation in a moment of rebellion. And this appears to be the crucial process in converting cultural resistance into a political movement. And that's one of the reasons why we invited him today. Without further ado, I'll leave the floor to our first speaker, Joe Fewsmith.
Thank you very much, Eugenio, and thanks to Global Programs and Santander Bank for sponsoring this. It's wonderful. It's an honor to be here. And I do want to make clear that I have a class at 1 o'clock, and so I will be getting up and leaving. I will do so huffing up in protest of Rowena's talk. No, not really. But I just wanted to let you know that I'm not protesting, but I do have to leave. And I think that's why I got the first slot of speaking here. I just want to make a few basic points. Obviously, Tiananmen, 25 years ago, it's hard to believe that a whole generation has grown up with absolutely no memory of this event. It's just striking. And in some ways, certainly when you go to China, I was there last week, you you know, China has developed so rapidly economically that this almost seems like it has dropped into, well, maybe dropped down the memory hole and is a completely forgotten event. And yet, I would argue that it is, the memory is there and probably will be renewed at some point in the future. It seems to me that as one thinks about this event, there are a couple of things about it. One is that it really interrupted a conversation, if you will, a conversation between state and society about how to open up the political system, how to have, if you will, more systematic citizen participation of voices from the state. And it interrupted, it truncated that conversation. And I would argue that this is a conversation that has to happen sooner or later in China. As it's developed so much, as so many Chinese citizens have become middle class or beyond middle class, have become educated. There are, I believe, 200,000 Chinese students in the United States now, and obviously more in other countries around the world, that are going to have different ideas than their parents and their grandparents. So, and this is a conversation that needs to happen. And it's been a conversation now that has been delayed for 25 years and maybe delayed for quite a number more years. But I think it has to happen. And that's where I think the memory of Tiananmen, of missed opportunities, of roads not taken, I think all those issues are going to come back into the discussion. Obviously, as a political system, the Chinese system remains remarkably monocratic. That's not to say it doesn't have different views. It's to say that there is only one sort of authoritative view, an ideological view, if you will, of which Xi Jinping has been giving quite a number of interesting speeches lately. And the Chinese society is so much more diverse than it was 25 years ago. And so, you know, somehow you think this is a conversation that has to happen sooner or later, and we all hope that it happens sooner and peacefully. The other thing is that I think that because this conversation was truncated and legitimacy was quite weak in those years after Tiananmen, it was replaced by patriotic education and nationalism. And you know, if you look at Chinese high school textbooks, they're not written with great perception and depth. They're really, I'm afraid, quite simplistic. And I know that some of the high school teachers are quite good and diverge from the text. So it's not that high school students necessarily learn only the views that are in the textbooks, but they do have to learn those textbooks. And when I say learn, I do mean memorize. If you're going to take the Gaokao, the entrance exam, they're not interested on your riffs on the textbook and how creative you can be. They're interested in whether you can reproduce that particular paragraph. And at any case, that story of nationalism is something that I think has caused a lot of problems. It's something that the whole East Asia conversation revolves around, and obviously that can be conflictual, to say the least. The other point that I really want to make is that although certainly the Chinese leadership does not talk about Tiananmen on a daily basis, it weighs on their thinking on more or less a daily basis. And I think if you look at the growth of the so-called Weiwen, stability maintenance apparatus, boy, that was literally nothing back 25 years ago. And now, as many people have commented, that domestic security apparatus costs more than the military and external security. It is something that infuses sort of every place in China, and it's sort of ingrained in their blood these days to as they would say, nip it in the bud. Don't let anything develop, get going. I suppose that that's the reason, in simple terms, why some of the really moderate people are in jail. And I don't even have to talk about Liu Xiaobo. I think actually Liu Xiaobo is actually quite moderate. But I'm thinking about people like Xu Ruyong, who wanted to use the public to expose corruption. And the government said, no, no, thank you. We'll do it ourselves. We've reserved a seat for you over here. Pudra Chang, a great guy. Human rights lawyer. These are not rebels. Ibrahim Toti, Xinjiang, these are not rebels. And as Ruan and I were talking about it as we were getting our coffee, if you're not going to talk to the moderates, who are you going to talk to? You want the middle. The problem in Chinese politics throughout the 20th century, it seems to me, is always the middle drops out. And I think what you need is a way to support that middle ground again and get a conversation going. Everybody has a stake in. Because for me, Tiananmen was really a political meltdown. The political system could not work out problems either within the state or between state and society, and was a political meltdown. Another political meltdown in the future would, I think, be infinitely more expensive. And so I think you need to try to find a middle ground to have that conversation and bring about more of an opening to society. So I'm going to stop there and pass the microphone.
So it's now the turn of our colleague, Rob Weller.
I'm going to go up to the
back. Oh, okay, sure.
I want to see the background.
He's a teacher, after all, right? Yes, he's standing.
I'm just short and I can't see. So I'm the anthropologist in the group, and I'm going to do what we do, which is just tell you a story. Not a 1989 story, it's a 2014 story. I spent last year on leave living in China, so this is just, it's a conversation I had one night with a colleague, a local person in the large eastern city where I was living, who was an academic and had a research grant to do oral histories of Hui people who lived in that city. Hui are Muslims who had been in that part of China for hundreds of years by then, so these are long established Muslim communities. And I saw her, I had dinner with her the night after she started this project. So she had interviewed four or five of these ancient Hui people. So nothing to do, oral history, yes, but nothing, 1989 was far too recent for her to be interested in. This was the early memories of people who are now in their 80s or 90s in some cases. So 1930s, Japanese invasion, 1940s, Civil War, 1950s, in the early years of after the revolution. That's what, that was the key for this. So I could tell she didn't look happy. I said, how did it go? And she said, it wasn't good. Nobody would talk. Nobody would say anything. All they would say is, thanks to the wonderful leadership of the Communist Party, everything is so much better than it used to be. But that was it. No substance of any kind. Now, those of you who know China, which I think is any of you in this room, you know, that kind of story, everything was horrible, and then the revolution came, and then everything was great. That's a, especially for people of that old generation, that's a very rehearsed story. They've told this over and over and over. So that's all she got. She said, only one guy would talk. Only one guy said anything. So what did the one guy say? And it was a very old man. And he said some interesting stuff about, you know, how the Japanese came, it was so bad for the Muslims because it was just a few days after Ramadan ended and they hadn't fled the city the way most of the Han population had fled the city, and it was especially bad for them. It was pretty interesting. And then he talked about after the revolution, he was from a small suburban town of this large city, where I had been actually, and been to the mosque and had an old Hui community now reduced to just a few people. And when we asked there what happened, where did they all go, we couldn't really get, we asked the Ahong, the imam from the mosque. He didn't really have a good explanation. And so this guy said, basically, the Red Army came, and it shot all the Muslim leaders. Now, is it true or not true? I don't know. You know, I kind of talked to my friend about this. She didn't know either. That's not the point of the story. She said, so he told me this really interesting story about what happened in 1949, 1950, 1951. And she said, and I can't do anything with this. I can't ever publish this. I can't even publish this in English. There's plenty of things you can publish in English that you couldn't publish in Chinese. But she said, I can't even publish this in English. And she got very upset. And she said, what am I doing? Why am I wasting my time? Why am I here? Why don't I do what my classmates did? You know, they're just in business. They don't worry about this stuff. They have all this money, much more than me. Why am I doing this? She said, nobody tells the truth in China. Nobody's told the truth since 1989. I haven't told the truth. She's a party member. I haven't told the truth since 1989. And that's why I'm telling you this story, right? It's that. That was it. It was a sort of horrible night. Tears coming to her eyes. So that's the story. It fits with what Professor Fusemith just talked about, right? That is, it's a change. And you need to think about her generation and her background. She is a woman in her very late 40s at this point. She was born just on the eve of the Cultural Revolution, so elementary school, very Cultural Revolution kind of experience, but suddenly everything changes around the time she's in high school. When she gets college, everything has opened up. When she gets graduate school, right, this is the mid-80s, the late 80s. This is the most open period China has experienced since 1949, probably since well before 1949. Everything was opened up. Everything was possible. This is the moment when she discovers what it means to be a scholar, a real scholar, somebody who questions, somebody who looks for the truth. And that was a moment in China where that was a real possibility, where you could do that. And for her, that's what 1989 meant. It meant the shutting off of that. It meant the change to patriotic education and nationalism, just what Joe had talked about, from what she imagined. It meant the inability to talk in an open way about real history that had really happened. It meant that you couldn't tell the truth in China. Now, is she representative of the Chinese people? No. I mean, nobody's representative of the Chinese people. There are too many Chinese people for that to be a possibility. She's a representative of a particular generation, right? It was because she was where she was in school at that point in Chinese history. That's why she thinks that. So it's her generation and her educational background. But that, so if you think about that, that's a very small portion of China's population. On the other hand, it's arguably the most important portion of China's population. These are the people moving into leadership positions right now, that college-educated, graduate school-educated, late 40s, early 50s, right? Those are the people moving into leadership positions all across China right now. So I think the depth of her cynicism represents something, represents a legacy of 1989. It's not that she was upset about what happened at Tiananmen. Not that she was one of those people out in the square still holding anger or even memory of it particularly. It's the aftermath. It's the way China decided to construct itself as a polity as a result of 1989 that I think led to this kind of feeling, and that a feeling that's really widespread in this very important piece of China's population. And I'm just going to stop at that point. We can talk more about questions if you want.
Thank you, Joe. And now it's the turn of our guest, Rowena.
Thank you so much. It's such a great honor to be here today. And before I start, I would like to thank the Boston University Global Program and the Center for the Studies of Asia for organizing this event. And in fact, I feel very humbled to be in this panel because Professor Phil Joseph Smith and Professor Welder, I've been reading your work since I was a graduate student, so I feel humbled to be on the same panel with them. And I actually first met Professor Manigan a few weeks ago when I was with my students at the Harvard Yangtze Library using the Tiananmen Archives. If any of you have know that we have 28 boxes of artifacts from the Tiananmen movement in the Tiananmen Tiananmen Archive. So on that day, I was with my students exploring what something happened, you know, before they were born. And then today, he's organizing this event, engaging students again on campus. So it's probably the one of the best moments for someone like me who lives with Tiananmen and studied Tiananmen for, you know, almost over a decade. Because for the 8 years, as you talk about, I work on the topic, it's not something encouraging and happy. I have to confess I was depressed most of the time when I was working on my topic. Every day you hear about this death and suffering and tears. And the worst thing, as Professor Waller had already mentioned, for our generation in 1989, we didn't take to the street because of anger, because of grievances, because of frustration, like people now take to the street. We took to the street because of hope, because of love, and even because of our trust in the government that they will reform themselves. And what did we face eventually, right? It was AK-47 to 200,000 army soldiers equipped with guns and tanks during with what we call the Tiananmen generation, right? So I think many of you remember what happened in 1989. Millions of Chinese nationwide took to the street, pushing for political reform and the peaceful demonstrations, especially students hunger strike in Tiananmen Square, ended on June 4th with the People's Liberation Army firing on unarmed civilians under the gaze of the entire world. Even today, we do not know how many have been killed. We do not know how many were injured on that fateful night. The only number, as I told you, is 200, over 200 army soldiers participated in the lethal action. That was 1989. And all I remember so well all those years, and especially immediately after the massacre, as Professor Fowler talked about, it's not just that much about what happened on that night. It's the fear that people didn't even know what happened to us. The fear that we can't even speak out. And I did not get to know any of this, that the sheer fear was felt by so many people until I interviewed the people in my book. The first story I told was Leanne Lee's story. She was a student from Hong Kong. I'm not sure how many of you here today are from Hong Kong. So she represented the Federal Students Union in Hong Kong, the same organization that recently organized the Hong Kong protest at this time. So she represented the students. Six of them went to Beijing to support the student struggles. And she would have never expected that it ended that way. So in my book, I started by telling the stories about she watching two young boys were shot and covered in blood and taken away from her. I told this story every semester when we went to the Tiananmen Archive to my students, just to tell them how much in those days people wanted to make sure that the blood of the Chinese people would not be shed in vain. And one day that this would be carried on and the stories would be told. So Leanne was, she fainted after the two boys were carried away and covered in blood. But that's not the story that I wanted to tell you. So when the first ambulance came, people started to push her into the ambulance. And then she said, she had heard the story before I told her. So she said, I'm not wounded. Why would you push me into the ambulance? And then the second ambulance came. The same thing happened immediately. Everyone just tried to push her into the ambulance. And she said, what's wrong with you people? I'm not wounded. Look at all these people. They need to get into the ambulance. Why you keep pushing me into the ambulance? And it was at that moment that a female doctor knelt down and held her hands and said that she spoke to her in English, very strange, right? She still speak to her in Cantonese. Of course, she may not be able to speak Cantonese, not in Mandarin. She spoke to her in English. She said, child, we know that you're not wounded, but we also know that you're from Hong Kong, which means you're the only person here who can leave this country. We want you to live a life to tell the world what our government did to us tonight. That was Leanne's story. Of course, later on, the book also mentioned in 1997, when Leanne tried to tell the story in front of a group of Chinese students, welcoming the president of Jiang Zemin's visit in the U.S. And they were and those students and Chinese, they were raising red flags surrounding her, and they called together, they shouted together, they yelled at her together that you are a liar, you are a liar. So that was the beginning of this story, and I continue by mentioning an event that Leanne and I went together. So it was 19 years after the massacre. For the first time, actually, we were together at a candlelight vigil, and Leanne has become a mother. You know, she was around your age, my age. We were around your age in 1989, and then 19 years after, she has become a mother. And then we participated in a candlelight vigil in Toronto, and she took her daughter with her. And the whole night, that little girl kept jumping ups and downs. And every time she jumped, she said, "Mommy, mommy, where are the brothers and sisters? Where are the brothers and sisters?" She's talking Cantonese, right? "Mommy, mommy, go over there, I didn't know, go over there, I didn't know." And then Leanne just ignored her. And when Leanne went over to lay down the candle, and she turned to me, she said, Auntie, where are the brothers and sisters? Mommy didn't tell me. Didn't know where the brothers and sisters." Obviously, Leanne told her they came for the brothers and sisters. And I think that was the moment I remember probably for the rest of my life, is that image. 19 years after, we didn't even know whether the two boys survived. We don't even know their name. We can't even go and investigate and find out who they are and if they had survived. I only wish I was as eloquent as the female doctor who held her mother's hands in Tiananmen Square in 1989. But all that I could do is just to kneel down and hold her hands and speechless. So I think that I use this as the beginning of my book because I think it tells you everything. You do not need to know a lot of theory, idea, democracy, concepts. I think it just tells you everything about 1989 did not just end in 1989. 1989 was just the beginning of an end. On the surface, Tiananmen seems to be totally remote and irrelevant to the reality of the rise in China today. But the Tiananmen murders are still not allowed to openly mourn their children. The exiles, the people I wrote about in my book, they are not even allowed to return home for their parents' funerals. Scholars who write about Tiananmen, Perry Ling, Andrew Levin, all banned from going to China. So Tiananmen really epitomize the relationship between history and memory, power and politics, human rights, intellectual freedom in the Chinese context. It's not exaggerating to say it's impossible to understand today's China without understanding the spring of 1989. Because while those in power, they can easily manipulate and twist and erase history and memory, but the manipulation of history and memory is always accompanied distortions of all kinds, social, political, cultural, psychological, everything in the society. So 1989 did not end in 1989, and don't forget that I think the worst part about what the government did is not just about the erasure and the twisting of history and memory, but more the twisting of values, some of the universal basic values. The moment they tell the people that we have to kill these people so that to achieve a higher goal of stability and prosperity, and that basically sends the message to the whole population that human rights and human lives, human decency and human dignity can be sacrificed for whatever important goal that we consider would be. So I think that's actually the root of many of the social political problems in China. And for the younger generation, Professor Joseph talked about nationalism, and actually that's my postdoc project at Harvard, and I am having a paper coming out. I would be happy to share with you all about the roots of Chinese student nationalism, and I'm not going to go into detail. Maybe we can go into details later on during Q&A, but it's produced a whole generation very different, I would have to say. Of course, I can't overgeneralize, but we have different values and perspective about what's important, the twisting of the values, and understanding of being patriotic, right? While students of the 1980s, we believe that we were following the Confucian descent, which means we are going to train the rulers to improve So 1989 was never a real sense of revolution because the students, the major role players in 1989, they were not looking for what now we call the regime change, which means you overthrow the government is a real sense of revolution. On the contrary, as I mentioned at the very beginning, it just following the Confucian descent is out of love and trust and faith in the government to reform itself. But after 89, and I think the post-89 generation, the government has been successfully turned them to not to be able to distinguish between the region and the nation and reject any serious criticism as being a national traitor, right? So as a criticism of the people and the nation and the culture. So that's one thing that the government has been very successful in doing. And very quickly, am I running out of time now?
Yeah, maybe we can conclude.
Okay, so at the same time, the Tiananmen murders, the group who had lost their children and family members, they had been fighting a war of memory against forgetting. And the past quarter century is really a war between the power and the powerless. Like on one hand, the government has ordered state machinery to reconstruct a narrative about what happened and why happened. Happened in 1989. At the same time, these murders led by Professor Ding Zilin at the People's University, whose son Jiang Jianlian were shot and killed at the age of 17. Right. So she started this one-woman campaign and started to collect the information with the murders. And it's through her efforts that we got to know some of the very high-profile cases. For example, Dr. Xiaobo at the Chemistry Department of Beijing University, who was shot and killed at the age of 27, leaving behind his twin baby sons. And that's not the end of it, as Professor Weller reminded us earlier. It's the worst, it's the later part, right? So the university authorities told this wife, you're not supposed to tell anyone about your husband, otherwise you would not be able to stay in our university housing anymore. And the young mother, she felt that she couldn't afford to be homeless with her baby son. So she remained silenced, invisible, until in 1993, Professor Ding Zilin eventually found them and added her husband as number 8. I didn't have the map and the things, so I have some maps and then the chart about these people, the victims' names. They were not arranged alphabetically based on their last name, but they were arranged by the order that the information of each victim information came to light. Right. So and then through that two maps. That volunteer put together based on the information collected by the mothers. You can see one map was the locations where the bodies were found, the other was the map where the people were killed. You can clearly see that the massacre happened throughout central Beijing. So the Chinese government had been using the wicked leakage to say that no people were killed in Tiananmen Square, that's why there's no such a thing called the Tiananmen Massacre. But through Ding Zilin's information, you can clearly see that there were people that were killed in Tiananmen Square. For example, Cheng Renxin from the Renda People's University, he was shot and killed right next to the Tiananmen Qigan, the flag pole of Tiananmen Square. But whether people were killed inside Tiananmen Square was not central question here at all, because we all know Tiananmen is just a symbol. When you said Tiananmen movement, it did not just happen in Tiananmen Square, it happened all over China. And the Tiananmen massacre actually is more like a Beijing massacre. Happens throughout central Beijing. So I'm not going to go into details because all these are documented in my book with all the information. So final note, Tiananmen may remind of us of repression, yes. But in these days when people talk about Hong Kong, they do not like people to relate that to Tiananmen because they were concerned that people will be afraid and saying that. But let me remind you, Tiananmen is also a democracy movement starting April 15 up to June 4th. So Tiananmen also symbolize people's power and human beings longing for freedom and justice. As we all know, the desire for freedom is just deeply human, and the longing for universal rights, for basic rights, is universal. I'm sure history is going to witness the Tiananmen spirit as the power of the powerless again and again. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we open the floor to question and answers. We have a microphone here. I don't know if anybody from Global Programs maybe can help us navigate with the microphone. Thank you so much. So we will be taking questions. One question here.
So my question is, Would you draw some parallels and specify some differences with what's happening in Hong Kong today and the implications for the future?
Sure. Yeah, so I think anyone who has been following Hong Kong these days, I'm not sure how many of you have been following.
Is there any way that you can turn the microphone
up? Speak a little bit louder.
Oh, yeah. The microphone is not on?
It's no, it is on, but you have to speak a little louder.
Oh, okay. I have to shout. No, I'm just teasing. Like a podcaster.
Use your classroom voice.
Okay, that's my classroom voice. Okay. Yeah, oh, maybe I'm just not, you know, speaking to the microphone. Now it's better. Yes, of course. I think anyone who has been following the protest, I spoiled myself so much that I wasted all my time just watching Hong Kong for a few weeks when it first happened. And it's very difficult not to be reminded of 1989, right? The young faces, people from all walks of life, they came out to support the students, and even the non-violent, peaceful nature and characteristics of the movement. So all this reminded me of 1989, yes. But there are major differences, too. Most important, I think the students participated in the Occupy movement in Hong Kong. And by the way, they don't just call it Occupy movement. They want to distinguish that with peace and love. That's why they said Occupy with peace and love, because Occupy sounds very violent. And I don't think they had the kind of illusions that regeneration, that Tiananmen generation had in 1989. They would not think that, okay, there would be no crackdown. They would not think that the government would be nice and generous to them. So that's one thing that I think is very different from 1989. And the second thing is, I think the students now who are the major role players in Hong Kong, they actually received their political baptism dating back to 2011 and 2012, and when Joshua Wong Ji-feng, the leader of the whole movement, he led the students of this anti-national education campaign. So if any of you have been following the news, you know the anti-national education campaign was very similar to the patriotic education campaign that was first launched in 1992 in China, when the government tried to reestablish legitimacy after the Tiananmen crackdown. So they tried to do something similar in Hong Kong, and that was the first time the students, the mothers, they took to the street, and then they actually occupied that area. Now it's called Civic Square in Hong Kong. Right. So at that time, it was right in front of the government building. And then they went over there, they had hunger strike, and the mother said that, I am going to use my life to defend my kids' rights to think critically and independently. I don't want this brainwashing propaganda program to be implemented in our college. So that was the first time they started their political baptism. And you can see that one major idea about how differently they see their role. It's, for example, in 1989, if any of you have watched some of the footages, you saw the students were kneeling down outside the People's Congress, and then they were holding the petition, waiting for the Chinese government to accept the petition. And in 2011, when George Wang trying to submit his petition to CY Leung, the chief executive of Hong Kong, he did not kneel down. And when CY Leung even tried to shake hands with him, instead of shaking hands, he just stepped back and he bowed. And he explained later that, I don't want to shake hands with him because I do not want to indicate any cooperation with this leader. But I understand the necessity to show respect. That's why I bowed instead. So that was one image that you can see the differences and different understanding about the roles the students play. And then the second image, in 1989, Wu Kai-si, when before Gorbachev's visit, he was begging the students, he said, let's move, leave the square so that the government can receive Gorbachev. You know, any of you who studied the history of 1989, you would know that Gorbachev was actually visited China for his first time in 30 years, and that was why all the media were there. So they tried to move, work as you were trying to ask the students to move from that space of Tiananmen Square so that the government can receive Gorbachev. And this time, George Wong, also the student leader, instead of saying that, let's move back. And that's exactly how the whole movement escalated. He said, let's take back our square. Let's take back Civic Square. And then they all climb up the barriers, and then they occupied that place. And then the police came in, and that was how the next day, everyone, you know, all these people, thousands of people in Hong Kong came out to support them. So you see in social movements, space is always connected with identity, what they see their roles. And from this, you can actually see the power of information that had play in the younger generation in Hong Kong. I think this time the major role players, although young people in Hong Kong, they are actually informed citizens. They are informed citizens in the most modern sense in the way that they wanted to, whatever they want is just to push, to make contributions, to make the society a better place. I speak too much.
Let me just say one word so that we have time for some other people to speak from the floor. But I would also emphasize the differences between the Hong Kong movement and the 1989 movement. First of all, it's Hong Kong. It's not Beijing. That's a huge difference. So we have a tradition, Rowena referred to part of it. Hong Kong, they have a lot of practice doing political demonstrations. Of course, sort of students, college students in Beijing did too, but in such a different context, a completely different context. Second, 2014 is not 1989. So we just had all these Occupy movements all over the world, but especially here, China knows how those worked out here. And I think you can see them right now after many missteps at the beginning, right now doing a strategy that looks a lot more like what New York or mm-hmm. Boston did. Right, so that it's just, you know, time passes, history changes. It's not the same. It's not the same.
I'd like to ask.
The mic.
For the panelists, how do you think we should make the studies more open? So despite the censorship and like cross-linguistic approaches, but mainly to the Chinese inside China who are brought up in that social political context and who would be more directly involved in bringing about policy change.
I'm not sure if I understand the question. So you mean what we can do to
make your studies to have a more direct impact on the young generation in
can we get information like your book
into China.
People in China.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, I think the most important thing is free access to information, right? So without free access of information, the last week of my class, I always ask my students, imagine tomorrow we can just go to China and then all open up. What are you going to do to have an investigation about what happened? They would say, I'm going to talk to the lawyer. I'm going to talk to the doctors. I'm going to talk to this and that. So we were all excited. We already have many plans about how to figure out what happened in 1989. So I think the key right now, what we need in China is some of the very basic elements for civil society, citizens' education here, which is free press, free speech. But none of this available, no rule for nothing. So without this, I think that the development of civil society forces in China will continue to be very difficult. And get back to your question, what we can do, I think we are all doing it, right? You are here, we are here. We are talking about it and we try our best. And some people even try to do this at the cost of their freedom and their rights to go home.
You know, when my friend had the very depressing story about studying the Hui, and the rest of the conversation, the rest of the night, was me and her husband both trying to say, but, you know, this is important, do it anyway. Write it down. Yeah, you can't publish it, but write it down so it exists. Maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's 100 years, but someday, because these informants are dead in a few more years. You know, these are very, very old people. And I think that's kind of the same answer. So the immediate answer is, we can't. We can't break down the control over information. It's not 100%, but it's pretty powerful in China. But the longer term answer is, we can do what Rowena has done and what other people have done in other kinds of ways, which is make sure the material is there someday, so that when people want access to it, there is access to it.
I have to be a little bit. I have to confess that it's not like I don't feel any fear of doing it. The whole time I'm very scared. I'm very worried. I'm very concerned that what would be the consequences for writing this book, for doing this kind of work. I'm not pretending that I'm very courageous, and then I don't think that those are the obstacles. But I think that we are all trying our best. to do it the way that we can.
Hi, I have two questions. One for Professor Weller. I want to ask you, you said that there are two reasons that Hong Kong protests Do you think which one plays a bigger role? The time cost or the location cost? Because obviously Hong Kong played a the Chinese central government played a more moderate reaction to the Hong Kong protest. Because globalization, more and more people they take serious. They know more about Tiananmen Square. So there's a very negative impact on the Chinese Communist Party. Do you think Chinese Communist Party be aware of this negative impact so that just change their behavior? And for Professor He, do you think what's the biggest legacy of?
So on the Hong Kong question, I think the place might make the biggest difference. So the Chinese government is very aware of what goes on in other parts of the world, and gave a lot of thought after 1989 to what screwed up. What didn't Joe call it a meltdown or political meltdown or something like that? Right? They thought so too, and so it's not just Tiananmen Square. The collapse of the Soviet Union and that whole thing, right, this exact same time, basically, a few months later, that they really studied that and paid attention to that in order not to have that happen there. So you can see very much of what they've done is a change of strategy. They completely rethought how they should handle these kinds of issues. And it's not that they put down all social protests. There are tons of social protests in China. But they make sure they do everything possible to make sure the scale remains small. Right, so it's social protest that they can use, in a sense. Hong Kong, I honestly see the Hong Kong thing much more influenced by the global Occupy movement than by the legacies of Tiananmen Square. It was a new technique of protest that the Hong Kong people have discovered, and it's worked pretty well. Insofar as it worked well here, which is it got publicity for a certain kind of point of view that would not have happened otherwise. That's happened in Hong Kong as well. Is it going to transform the system, I would say, to the exact same level that it transformed the system here, which is zero, something like zero.
So you think location?
The biggest legacy of Tiananmen, I think, like locally, regionally, internationally. Locally, I think the Chinese government keep reminding us by imprisoning people, exiling people, that this is a big legacy. Right? I'm just being ironic. So every year they try to arrest people, they imprison people so that you don't talk about it again. And even this year, I'm not sure if you're following the news, four scholars were arrested in May because they had tried to have a symposium at home on Tiananmen, and they were detained. And Professor Joseph mentioned one of them are still being detained. So in Chinese, sense of detained is not 24 hours. They can detain you for 2 years. So I think locally, we already talked about all the impact. And then in Hong Kong, I think Tiananmen really was the turning point, watershed, political conscience of the whole generation or several generations. Everyone who remember Tiananmen tried to pass down that information to the younger generation. That's why you see the Victoria Park, you see all these candlelight. And then I think that it actually inspired generation after generation. Hong Kong to try to make sure that they do not need to get into that kind of darkness like the people in 1989. And globally, Professor Wallen already mentioned the fall of the Berlin Wall and things like that. And I hope that you don't go away with a pessimistic message. I think that, in fact, many of the Tiananmen veterans are major role players of the human rights defenders movement in China these days. So, it may seem as a failure in 1989, but as we see any social movement, it's hard to tell until maybe decades later that what kind of role and impact it actually had on the society and the world.
Can I add one sentence to that? You said something I think that was important, but you said it really quickly. And that's every time China says, don't remember Tiananmen, they're reminding everybody about Tiananmen. So the really obvious stuff, like in late May, every year, Gmail suddenly disappears.
Yeah.
Everybody knows why. Or you all know, you know, if you put June 4th in social media in China, that gets censored out, right? So then people are clever. They start writing about May 35th, and right, there's these kinds of jokey things, and then that gets banned, right? But every time they do anything like that, it's like, say, remember what you're supposed to forget. Remember. And that's really important. That does keep it from being forgotten.
So I just have a question about like the current Chinese student nationalism right now. So given the huge number of Chinese students going overseas for like university, like undergrad and even like, high school at this point, do you feel like how do you feel that would impact the future of like civil society development in China? And do you feel like, you know, as an educator in the West, do you feel like what kind of role do you feel we should play in like, you know, expanding their understanding?
As well as his implications. Jeez. it's not that I don't want to answer the question. It's all in my paper, so I can send you my paper, but very, very, very briefly, because it involved political socialization and it involved the de-socialize and re-socialize the process. And then that's an excellent question. That's exactly how I started the paper. But in general, one word, I think, once again, I think there's a major difference between citizen education and political indoctrination. And then after 1989, right. The government basically learned that, okay, they learned one thing. In 1989, they tried to lock the doors of all the universities. I'm not sure if you know the details. They locked the doors, but then as young people at BU, you know that if the school locked your dorm store, you will find a way to go out. So after 1989, as Professor Vowler said, they learn to do it differently. How are you going to make sure that next time, even if all the doors are open, the students would not even want to go out? And that's locking their minds. That's how the patriarchal education started, right? So lock the minds next time, you know, you criticize China, they would jump out. So now all students know one fact. There's only one kind of protest that would be that you can just go out and you will not get punished. That is when you participate in anti-US and anti-Japan demonstrations. Right? That's the only reason you can take to the streets. So the implications of all this kind of post-89 education changes. So I documented all this too in my
paper. So we have very little time left. So we will take two very quick questions, and let's take them together. First, in the first line, and then the gentleman at the back. Please keep them short, and also your answers. Thank you.
I'll try to make it brief. So my uncle was 18 years old in 1989, so he was actually one of the minor student leader, not someone like Wu Kaixi, but a student leader for his high school. And one of the slogans they have was like, Deng Xiaoping is like a moon. Like he changed all the time, not the same in January and February.
Yeah, I know that.
So he doesn't keep his words. He's not consistent. And then my grandfather asked him, so if you say he's like a moon, what does he look like in January and what does he look like in February? So what he said, why you said like he changed all the time? And my uncle was like, oh, actually, I know nothing, like, I don't know what he said, I know, like, it's just our slogan. So, like, apparently everybody was very excited and they were eager to do something in the Tiananmen Square. But was there, were they really clear about what they are doing, or is there a unified goal, like, everybody agree upon with, or...
Okay, and so let's collect the other question,
okay,
quick question.
My question is...
First of all, thank you very much. Very interesting conference. I'm the victim of Japanese atrocities since 1930 to 1945. I'm part of the oldest person here. Let me ask you one question. China's government at the moment is globalized in many places. I've been there since 1973 with 20 groups. I see how Chinese government, I was in Chinese army too now. Chinese government, whatever they do at the moment,
think the direction they're moving better or worse for the Chinese people as a nation? 56 minorities.
Okay.
We have very few here. Number one. Number two, also is very interesting. Somebody was saying that younger generation like you, you never remember Tim Harvin. How many of them, even at our age, remember Kent State? See, the young people want to identify themselves as such. The government actually, one of the gentlemen says, are they aware? They are very aware. Because at the moment, the Chinese government is actually the third generation. You are the fourth generation from Sima Mao.
Okay, can I respond? Because I respond, thank you very much.
I was just 73. I'd like to publish in the Chinese, see who they are now. I bet they are all running the government. They were wearing the red. I'd like to publish something. Thank you very much.
So very quickly, one thing that I just want to say, Kent State, we know how many were killed. We know that the whole country can talk about it. Even if you can choose whether you want to remember it or not, you want to know about it. And one important thing, there's a plate there remembering, commemorating those who were killed at the spot. If one day Tiananmen Square has a plate commemorating those who were killed in 1989, then I would say that it's the same. Right now, people cannot talk about it.
The past is a good place to visit. But not to live in it.
Yes, truth and reconciliation. Without truth, there will be no reconciliation.
Not because I'm not saying it in the world exactly the same, but in America, in China.
Yeah, the difference is now you have a plate. As I said, one day if China has a plate there in Tiananmen Square too, then we will say that is over. So truth and reconciliation. I think that China has to face its past in order to have a future.
And this question also from the student, is it possible to talk about a unified strategy at the time, or really the students didn't know what they were doing?
So the students actually have the seven demands, right? Free anti-corruption, free press, free speech. You are absolutely right that no one has any so-called clear demands of anything or what democracy was like. But they do have these seven demands starting in early April, what they wanted, free press, free speech, anti-corruption, and rule of law. So they did list all these things. But it's a nationwide movement, millions of students participated. Back to Deng Xiaoping, 初一十五,像月亮,初一十五不一样. Yeah, I know that slogan. So I think many people were actually very shocked, including us. Why Tiananmen happened? Deng Xiaoping seemed to be such a reform guy. And then I remember my father in the 1980s, he was saying, wow, now we have Gorbachev and Deng Xiaoping. This is such a great war instead of Stalin and Mao. But as Professor Rob McFarger clearly indicated, in the reason we were shocked because we did not see that Deng was always in favor of economic reforms, but not political reforms. One clear sign is in 1978 and 79, when the democracy happened, Wei Jingsheng was given 15 years of sentence. So that was the time China, Deng Xiaoping was saying that let's open up and reform. But still, he imprisoned this guy just for writing one article, the fifth democratization, the fifth modernization, which is democratization. So he imprisoned Wei Jingsheng. So from that, you can see that Deng has been consistently conservative about political reform from day one.
Thank you very much to our speakers, to all of you for engaging very much. And if you are interested more in democracy in East Asia, come to our event on December 1st and 2nd. One session here at the Castle at the U on the Taiwan elections. The second session will be at Harvard University at Fairbanks Center on December 2nd. Thanks again to everybody.
Thank you.